Morning, everybody. It is February 12th, I believe. And we are at John chapter 7, verse 1, which is actually technically where we were last week also. In fact, if I could please get you to settle down, thank you. In fact, it's ironic because people who are listening to the web posted recordings of this, last week's lesson is John 7 through whatever, first lesson, and then the verses listed are 7:53 through 8:11, because we spent most of last time introducing this new section that runs chapter 7, 8, 9, and a good bit of 10. But most of the time was talking about why the episode of the woman caught in adultery actually was not originally part of John's gospel. So that put us a little out of sequence, but I did that intentionally. Now we can go back and pick this up at verse 1 and start looking at what's really happening here. Remember, this section is built around the Feast of Tabernacles. And we talked about that a little bit at the end of last week. Tabernacles is the big feast as far as celebration and hoopla go at this time in Israel's history. Passover may arguably be more theologically significant, but Tabernacles is where all the partying takes place. So the city fills up, or rather the temple quarter fills up, and the city empties. And there are people everywhere. It is a crowded place. It is probably never more crowded in Jerusalem than it is for Tabernacles. 7-day feast. And we have the ritual of the water being taken from the pool of Siloam and poured out on the altar, and the 75-foot torches in the court of the women that are lit one night, so that you can see them from all across the city. And those are some of the backdrop to what Jesus has to say here. But first, he has to get there. And in the first verses of John 7, at first it looks like that even that's not going to happen. So what I'd like to do is read through verses 1 through 13, because some of the questions that come up right away, and this is so often true with John, we've seen it before, some of the questions that come up right away are actually informed by things that he says a little bit later in the section. It's almost like you'd be better off reading John backwards, which we're not going to do. But let's read 1 through 13 just to get that piece in place, and then talk a little bit about this. So John chapter 7, opening up this new section. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. Remember, this was after this, meaning after John chapter 6, where the whole bread of life discourse, and a lot of people left him. A lot of his followers turned away, and that's not insignificant to what's happening now. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. And just a reminder, when John is talking about the Jews, he almost always means the Jewish leadership. Now, the Jews' Feast of Booths was at hand. So his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers believed in him. Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I am not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." After saying this, he remained in Galilee. But after his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. The Jews were looking for him at the feast and saying, "Where is he?" And there was much muttering about him among the people. While some said, "He is a good man," others said, "No, he is leading the people astray." Yet for fear of the Jews, and again, that's the leadership, no one spoke openly of him. So he's the flavor of the month. And it's clear that the Jewish leadership's antagonism toward him is no secret. Because the general populace is all abuzz, but not openly. It's whispered conversations. It's dinner table conversations. It's street corner conversations with friends, but it's not anything out in the open, because nobody wants to cross the leadership that they know doesn't like this guy. But he's up in Galilee. He's been there ever since he decided to head north from baptizing by the Jordan. Remember that? And he heard that the Pharisees knew that he was out there. He was becoming very popular. A lot of people were going out to see him. And when he heard that the leadership knew that he was out there, he decided to withdraw up into Galilee. And we don't even know for sure that he came down for the last Passover, although one would think he did, because that was part of Torah observance. But the Passover story from chapter 6 isn't in Jerusalem. It's up around the Sea of Galilee. So he's staying out of Judea because they're looking for him and they basically want his head. But the Feast of Booths comes, and everybody and his brother, pun intended, is going to head for Jerusalem, and Jesus' brothers try to get him to go. Not only try to get him to go, but tell him, look, you've got this ministry. It's become a public ministry. So why on earth wouldn't you go down where you've got more public than you could ever get any other way and do what you do? And it's not an illogical question, because stop and think for a minute about the progression of what we have seen Jesus do in this book. What have been his signs? The first sign was turning water into wine at the Cana wedding. Now that's a semi-public thing to do. But when his mother asked him to do it, he wasn't entirely happy to be asked. And when he did it in a way that kept him out of sight. He went back to the kitchens, so to speak. He only dealt with the servants. And he wasn't the one who came out like the master of ceremonies and said, "Hey, look what we've done for you." So he kept it as non-public as he possibly could. He talks to Nicodemus at night, one-on-one, not public. He talks to the woman at the well in Samaria, one-on-one, when nobody else is coming to get water, not public. She takes it public in terms of going to talk to her community, and they come out to see him, yes. But in terms of what he initiates, it's not public. Nothing he has done has been public. Chapter 5, he heals the lame man at the pool. He doesn't do it as a show. He doesn't make sure he has an audience, although there are certainly people around. In fact, the man himself isn't sure who healed him. And the leadership is upset because they see him carrying his mat, and that's how they found out that there was a healing. And by then, Jesus has faded back into the crowd and slipped away. He has not done anything in an overt public way in his ministry up to this point in the stories that John shares. The first time he does anything publicly, it's chapter 6, where the people follow him out to the wilderness, to this mountain, and he does the miracle with the bread and the loaves. That's the first overtly public miracle in this book. And look what it got him. A lot of his followers turned and stopped following him. So against that backdrop, it makes some sense now for his brothers to say, look, you've gone public. And you lost a lot of followers. But if you've gone public, then go public. Head down to Jerusalem. Do what you've been doing. And see how many followers you get. That's their way of thinking. It's obviously not his way of thinking. And he tells them, in verse 6, my time has not yet come. But your time is always here. Jesus understands that his brothers are just like the rest of the unbelieving, they don't get it world that he's trying to address. The world cannot hate you, he says in verse 7, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. And that's a fair point. If there's somebody who's got a public ministry, think about the public ministries that exist today of a religious nature. Who's popular? The public ministries that exist today, in the religious public ministries, who's popular? Joel Osteen's popular, right? Well, when was the last time you heard Joel Osteen explain to the world that its works are evil? They don't want to hear that. They want to hear that everything's okay and that they're okay. Because it is our nature as fallen human beings. And Joel doesn't have to be the only example. You can pick a number of others. Joyce Myers. Go back a generation when Oral Roberts was big, or Jimmy Swaggart, or... Yeah, I know. They're still around. It is the nature of fallen human beings. It is the nature of fallen human beings to want to be in control, to want to be God over our own lives, and therefore to think that we are good. And we see somebody who is good, but not so much better than we are that it puts us to shame, and we think, yeah, now there's a good person. And I'm a good person. Until you meet a really good person, a truly good person, and then you don't feel so comfortable about yourself. Because then you see the difference. Well, there is no more truly, genuinely good person than the person of Jesus Christ. And he's not only there to see the contrast without it being stated, but he's stating it. He's telling the Jewish leadership, all of your good works under the Torah are in vain. And you think you're good, but you're not good. Who wants to hear that? So Jesus knows that if he does what his brothers want him to do, it is not going to go well. Now, ultimately, he is here for the express purpose of things not going well, in the sense of his suffering. But it's not time quite yet. It's especially not time to go with his brothers, because how are they, and he if he's with them, going to go up to the Feast of Tabernacles publicly? They're going to fold in with the throngs that are on the road. His brothers may very well put him into a situation like the wedding at Cana that he doesn't want to be in. They're trying to kind of push him out of the stage curtains into the spotlight. Probably as much for their own entertainment as for his, but we don't really know their motives beyond what they say. But that's not going to go well. If he goes publicly, then the word is going to spread out ahead of him through the crowds that he's coming to the feast. And the leadership is going to know before he gets there, and they're going to take action before it's supposed to happen. And so it is not yet his time. So he won't go with his brothers. Is he lying to them when he says, "You go, I'm not going to go up to this feast"? No, he's not lying. He isn't going to go up to this feast, not at this point in time, and certainly not the way that they're wanting to see him do it. It's a 7-day feast, and John makes the point of saying in verse 9, after saying this, he remained in Galilee. He did what he said he was going to do. He stayed behind. But there are lots of times where we say that we're not going to do something, and we don't mean we're never going to do it. We just mean we're not going to do it right now. And in fact, at some point later in the week, probably 1 to 3 days later, Jesus does go up to the feast. Very likely after the crowds have all gotten into the city, and the roads are not nearly so populated, and he doesn't have people around him who are going to try to push him into the spotlight. He can go up on his own terms, and he does. And he goes into the city without being noticed, it would appear. And so there we are.
Eric, my Bible has a footnote that says some manuscripts add yet.
Yeah. There are some manuscripts say, "I am not going up to this feast yet." And that is true. There are a lot of manuscripts that say that. But when you think about, well, this gets back into the textual criticism thing from last week, and I don't want to get all scientific about it again, but it boils down to this. When you look at which manuscripts say not and which manuscripts say not yet, the odds are very strong that the original reading is not, and that somebody added yet because they wanted to keep Jesus from looking like a liar. The more difficult reading is usually the right one, because usually a scribe wants to try to get rid of the theological tension or problem that he perceives, and adding the word yet would be a way to do that. But there's really no theological problem here. There's really no theological crisis here. It's not a question of Jesus lying. It's not a question of God changing his mind. Although if you wanted to go that route, there's precedent in the Old Testament where God is described as changing his mind too. So it's just that he was not going to go up to the feast at that point and in that way. Elmer?
Kind of my own interpretation, the way things work back then, be a rabbi, and he had his little posse, if you want to call it that, followers of his, and when they went somewhere, they would make a scene with 15 or 20 people walking in a place, all in one group, following away a particular person. And it would have been a grand entrance if he went there with his followed membership. I'm assuming it's not just the 12 he's talking about. There would be other people following him too.
Yes. I don't know how, I mean, I don't know that piece of cultural history that you describe where they'd go up in clusters with a rabbi leading each one, but to the extent that's true, then people would be looking at any given group and saying, well, who's the leader here? Who's the teacher here? And yeah, he'd get noticed. Absolutely. All right. So verse 10, he does go up. The Jewish leadership is looking for him and saying, where is he? And there's much muttering about him among the people. Is he a good guy? Is he not a good guy? Is he a hero or is he a villain? And there's disagreement. And then Jesus does a very, very interesting thing in verse 14. It's about the middle of the feast. So day 4, maybe day 3, day 5, somewhere in there. It's the middle of the feast. He goes up into the temple and he starts teaching. Well, so much for not being public. But think about it. What can the leadership do? What can the leadership do now? To catch him as he was coming into the city is a reasonably low profile thing to do. But to simply march up there and drag him down when he's teaching at the temple? And John just told us that at least some of the population, let's speculate it's a 50-50 split, half the population thinks he's a great guy. That's a lot more difficult. I mean, think ahead. When they finally do arrest him, how do they do it? In the middle of the night, in an obscure and secluded place. They're not looking for a public spectacle or a public controversy. So he goes into the temple and he begins teaching, and the Jews, tell you what, I'm past verse 13. Why don't we just read this section like we did the last one, down through verse 24, and then we'll talk about this. About the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began teaching. And I'm just going to substitute leadership here whenever John says Jews, just to make it clearer. The Jewish leadership therefore marveled, saying, how is it that this man has learning when he's never studied? So Jesus answered them, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory. But the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and in him there is no falsehood. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me? The crowd answered, you have a demon. Who's seeking to kill you? Jesus answered them, I did one work, and you all marvel at it. Moses gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well? Do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. It's fascinating to me the way this plays out. And what you've got to realize is that there are three characters on stage here, so to speak. There are three characters on stage here, and you have to realize that, because if you think there's only two, this doesn't make sense. There's Jesus, and there's the Jewish leadership, and there's the populace. There's the crowd. And what's going on here is that Jesus stands up and starts teaching in the temple, and when the leadership says, how does he do this? He's never been trained. He hasn't been to rabbinic school. Jesus either hears them or simply knows. We've seen that happen. And he responds to them. But he's responding to them in front of the entire populace. That's what's happening here. And so the things he says make perfect sense to the leadership, but they don't make perfect sense to the crowd. So when Jesus says, why are you trying to kill me? The crowd says, what are you talking about? But he's not talking to the crowd. He's talking to the leaders. He's just doing it in front of the crowd. So even though he has come to Jerusalem in his own time, and in his own way, he is ratcheting up the confrontation to a new level. Because in chapter 5, well, first of all, in chapter 4, when he knew the Pharisees had heard that he was having success out at the river, before they ever had a chance to come talk to him, he headed north. Then in chapter 5, when he did have a confrontation with the Jewish leadership, it seems to have just been him and them, he and they. No indication that there's a crowd at that point. It may have been, in fact, somebody here in this room speculated at the time. It may even have been in the Sanhedrin chambers below the temple court. We don't know where it was. But the only parties in that scene are Jesus and the leaders. Now, here's the next situation, and we've progressed from he avoids talking to them to he talks to them privately, and now he talks to them in front of the crowds. He is ratcheted this up a level, and that's important to see too. The tension continues to build as we go through John.
Eric?
Yes.
And it says in there about, you know, that they hear him preaching and teaching, and where does he get, you know, he hasn't had training and stuff. Are any of these people the same people that were there when he was there when he was 12 years old, and they were amazed at what he knew?
That's a great question. It's been about, give or take, 20 years since he was a 12-year-old knocking the socks off of people in the temple with his knowledge. Are they the same people? Some of them probably are. Do they realize this is the same person? One might think, well, some of them probably do. We don't know, Susan. But it's likely that at least somebody does.
I'm sure he's between 12 and now, if he's gone to Jerusalem, you know, many times in the Passovers and stuff, and he's preached before in the temple, hasn't he? Or is this...
The first Passover that John describes, he's at the temple and he says, you know, I'm the new temple. I mean, he doesn't say that, but that's the gist of that first episode. Yeah, he's in Jerusalem. John doesn't shed enough light on that for us to be able to answer that question categorically, but it is interesting to see how the leadership ignores the things they do know, and that we will see examples of that even in this story before we're done. So there may be some cognitive dissonance in play here. Certainly it's a very human thing to do, to ignore the details that don't fit your agenda.
I think that's what verse 24 is saying. Don't judge by appearances. You know, you don't get to set your own rules and judge because you think it's wrong. It's wrong, but judge right judgment. So he's condemning them with that statement.
He's condemning them with almost every statement. Yes. There's a lot of condemnation here. It's almost as if he was nice in chapter 5 when he talked to them after he healed the lame man, and now he's just a little bit less tolerant.
Isn't he referring back to that incident?
Oh, yes, very much so. There's a lot of reference here in chapter 7 to the episode in chapter 5. Absolutely true, and we'll see that. Let's get into that. So the Jewish leadership in verse 15 marvels because he hasn't been to rabbinic school, which is a wonderful indictment of, I'm afraid to say this, but I'm going to say it, which is a very interesting indictment of those systems that say you must have the training or you're not a capable teacher. You must be ordained or you don't have, well, we're in a church tradition that says that. We're all sitting here saying that, and I'm not going to say that that's a bad idea. I'm not saying that we're wrong to look at that. The church has to control what's happening and make sure that congregations aren't veering off into error. And so that sort of system is a legitimate thing. But when you get to the point of saying, well, if you're not ordained, you can't know anything, that's silly. That's ignoring the gifts that God gives as he wills. I'm not ordained. I think I'm doing okay as a teacher. But I'm also not authorized to just be the one that a church selects to go stand in that pulpit every Sunday. I fill in that pulpit from time to time, but I do it at Pastor Vern's behest and under the wing of his authority. Otherwise, I couldn't do it. And I have no problem with that. But their attitude here in the rabbinic context is, if you haven't been to the schools, then you don't know anything. And it's not just that you're not credentialed, it's that you're not knowledgeable. And they're saying, how is he so knowledgeable? It'd be a very different thing if they were to say, you can't do that, you're not credentialed. That's not what they're saying. They're saying, how does he know these things? He never went to school like we did.
There's that little bit of, in the Old Testament, your way to God and talk to God is through the priest. He's the one that offers the sacrifices. They read the description, interpret it, and the Joe Blow, he's more or less, I liken it to like you're in a phone booth talking to God, and you have to go through him before you can talk to God. Or when Christ came with the Holy Spirit, it's you and God. You have a direct line to God. You don't have to go to anybody else.
And, you know, they should know that in the sense that when you think about the Old Testament, you're right, Elmer, that it was an intermediary structure for Israel religiously. You went through the priest, and there was the high priest, and he's the only one who ever went into the Holy of Holies. And there was this intermediary structure. But the Holy Spirit would come down on prophets who didn't have schooling. The Holy Spirit would come down on kings who were not of the priesthood. The Holy Spirit was given to the workmen who fashioned the tabernacle to give them the knowledge to do what they were doing there at Sinai. There are precedents in the Old Testament that God will give his Spirit the way he will. Yeah. Yeah. So you're right, but it's not enough to justify their view of it. They should, even apart from understanding what we understand on the other side of the cross and the resurrection and the giving of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, even in their context, they should realize that God's not limiting himself as much as they'd like to think he is.
Wasn't part of it that they're kind of feeling like they were threatened, their authority and power? Because if Christ came preaching like this and everyone accepted him, then anyone could do it, I would think, in their opinion.
That may very well be. That may very well be. And we've talked before about their concern for how Rome is going to react if this guy turns out to be an insurrectionist, whether he intends to be or not. But if this becomes an insurrection, then we've got Rome to worry about. There have been too many insurrections in the last few generations. Right. So there are lots of reasons for them to be concerned. Yes. And Jesus answers them. And remember, he just says this right out publicly, which becomes very clear later. He says, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. And here is the first indictment against the Jewish leadership. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. And of course, the clear, silent implication is, and you don't. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority. But you're saying, how does he do this? He's never been to the rabbinic school. So you think I'm teaching under my own authority, but you think that because it's not your will to do God's will. He's telling them, you're outside the will of God. And that's why you don't get it. The one who speaks on his own authority, that would be you rabbinic leaders, seeks his own glory. But the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and in him there is no falsehood. So he's already indicting them, even in these sentences that might seem a little bit cryptic at first read. But he's saying, if you were interested in God's will, you'd know what's going on here. But the reason you don't get it is because you're not seeking God's glory. You're only seeking your own. And if it wasn't clear yet, he now makes it abundantly clear. Verse 19, Has not Moses given you the Torah? Yet none of you keeps the Torah. Well, that's what the Jewish leadership, that's what the rabbis pride themselves on, is the keeping of the Torah. And he's just flat out telling them, in front of the crowds, please don't forget, you don't keep the Torah. Why do you seek to kill me? And that's where we see the dynamic going on. The crowd doesn't know what happened back and forth between them in John chapter 5 with the healing of the lame man. And while the crowd may know, in fact, the crowd clearly does know that the Jewish leadership has antagonism toward him, not everybody knows that they actually want to see him killed. And so we get this statement, you have a demon, who is seeking to kill you? And then Jesus answers them, but I really think he's still talking to the Jewish leaders and not to all the people. Because think about what he says, and this is drawn directly back to John 5 again. I did one work, and you all marvel at it. And he makes it very clear in the end of verse 23 that that one work was the healing of the lame man. Moses gave you circumcision, not that it's from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. You will do that work on the Sabbath in order to maintain the Torah, because the Torah says that the circumcision has to be done on the eighth day. Well, if the eighth day happens to be a Sabbath, what do? And nobody questions this. You do the circumcision. You bring that child into the covenant. You make that child a member of the people of Israel, even though it's the Sabbath. That is an acceptable thing to do on the Sabbath. That is service to God that is okay on the Sabbath. Now, I'd love to take like 45 minutes of the Lutheran doctrine of vocation and read that all into what is service to God and what isn't. But this is not the time or place for that. So he says, you're willing to do that work on the Sabbath. You're willing to act upon the body of a baby boy on the Sabbath in order to make him part of God's people. Why are you angry with me for doing the same thing? That's what he's saying. If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well? You will act on the body of this baby boy to make him a child of God. I acted on the body of this man to make him a whole child of God in anticipation of the life of God to come. I didn't do anything different than what you do when you circumcise. There is no difference there. But you condemn me for it, doing the same thing you do. Do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. Think about what's really going on here, guys. My healing that man was no different than a circumcision on the Sabbath. I did in his body what God wanted to see done for him. I made him a whole child of Abraham. Where's the problem? So now this confrontation with the leadership starts to get processed and evaluated. And we see in verse 25, some of the people of Jerusalem therefore said, is not this the man whom they seek to kill? So some people do know, some people don't. And here he is speaking openly, and they say nothing to him. Can it be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ? I got to tell you, that's not the direction the rabbis want to see this go. But we know where this man comes from. And when the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from. Is that not a delicious irony? Because they say, we know where he comes from. This is what we had up in Galilee. We know this guy. His dad's a carpenter. We watched him grow up. He went to school with our kids. We know where he's from. But when Messiah comes, no one will know where he comes from. And the irony is, they only think they know where he comes from. Even on a human level, they think he's from Galilee. And there's another point here that we'll see where they say, Messiah's supposed to be of the line of David. He's supposed to come from Bethlehem. This guy's from Galilee. No, this guy's from Bethlehem. They just don't know the early story. They didn't have the Gospels to read the Christmas story yet. And they're wrong about where he comes from. So the irony is when they say, well, when the Messiah comes, no one will know where he comes from. And they, in fact, don't know where he comes from, even as they say it. It's a very delicious irony John puts in there. And by the way, going back to Sue's question, if there are any leaders here in Jerusalem who do remember him from when he's 12 years old, they do know where he comes from. Just saying. So Jesus proclaimed as he taught in the temple, you know me, and you know where I come from. But I have not come of my own accord. He who sent me is true. And him you do not know. I know him, for I come from him, and he sent me. That sounds pretty cryptic. Maybe they understand that he's talking about God the Father, or they wouldn't be Trinitarian about it. Maybe they understand that he's talking about Yahweh. But it's pretty cryptic in the way he said it. At least it seems cryptic. But in any case, they were seeking to arrest him. That would be the leadership again. But no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. Yet many of the people believed in him. They said, when the Christ appears, will he do more signs than this man has done? So it's a picture of real public opinion mayhem, if you will. Clearly, there are people who know that the leadership doesn't like him. There are even some who know that the leadership would like to kill him. But there are plenty who have no idea that that's how bad it is. There are people who know where he comes from and therefore can't possibly see how he could be Messiah because he's from Galilee where they are, or at least they know he's from there. There are people who hear what he says and think, wow, I don't know what else he could check off the list. He just might be the Messiah. And there are people who say, no, he's leading Israel astray. Which is very much the way the leadership is seeing it. There's a lot of different opinions going on. A lot of different levels of understanding. All mixed through this huge crowd at the Feast of Tabernacles. And all it really does is demonstrate the polarization that's taking place. Because to the extent that the people agree with the Jewish leadership and see him as a danger, the leadership would be emboldened to act. But to the extent that a significant number of the people begin to see him as the Christ and start to believe in him, then the Jewish leadership is going to feel more and more pressure, and they may still be pressured to act. So the tension builds no matter which way this goes. But of course, the way this goes is that the crowd is divided. The general population is divided on how they see him. John's making that very clear. How are we doing on time? Okay, we're good. So now they do try to take action in verse 32. The Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things about him. And I'm interpolating into this. And so they decided they'd better act now before it got worse. And the chief priests and Pharisees sent officers to arrest him. These would not be Roman soldiers. This would be part of the temple garrison. They had their own little military. Just like the soldiers who would later be posted to guard the tomb weren't Roman soldiers. They were from the temple guard. So they send officers to arrest him. Jesus then said, "Don't worry about it, guys. There's no need. I'm not going to be here that long." Jesus then said, "I will be with you a little longer, and then I'm going to him who sent me. You will seek me, and you will not find me. Where I am, you cannot come." The Jews, verse 35, said to one another, "Where does this man intend to go that we will not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks? What does he mean by saying, 'You will seek me and you will not find me, and where I am you cannot come'?" So yet again, as we have seen so many times, as we saw with Nicodemus and the woman at the well, and even the Jewish leadership, they don't get it. They're in a completely different paradigm. They're thinking in a completely different mindset than what Jesus is. And so they don't get what he's saying. If he says, "I'm not going to be here that much longer," then they think that must mean he's leaving the country. And he's going to go out to the diaspora Jews who are outside of the Holy Land. That must be what he means.
But no one picks up on "to him who sent me" in that phrase. They kind of just gloss over that.
Yeah, they do. At least for now. But don't forget that. That may yet come back. Incidentally, it's also interesting. I mean, it's interesting to see just another example, and it just reinforces what we've been seeing, as I just said, how if you're not able to break that paradigm, if you're not able to get outside of the way you're thinking and see what Jesus is trying to say, it almost becomes a little laughable from the Christian point of view. It's kind of funny when Nicodemus says, "What, you're going to find some way to get back inside your mother's womb and be born again? That's crazy." The woman at the well says, "Oh, I would love to have water that I would drink and never be thirsty again. Where is that?" And he talks about bread, and the people thinks he means literal bread and not spiritual food. And he talks about drinking his blood, and they think he means it seriously, and that's a violation of Torah, and that drives them away. And now he's talking about not being around much longer, so they figure that means he's going on a journey. Well, he is, but not the way they think. It's also interesting for him to say, "I will be with you a little longer," verse 33, "and then I am going to him who sent me. You will seek me, and you will not find me." I don't know that this is what Jesus is referring to, but it is very... I'll hold that because I see a hand. Muriel, what's your question or thought?
Do they only know the Torah, those first five books, Isaiah, other prophets have already talked about this book coming?
Right.
The things that we're talking about are already mentioned. What knowledge base do they have?
They have the Old Testament. They have what we know as the Old Testament. They have the law, and they have the prophets. And in between them, the historical books are considered part of the prophets. The law, the writings, and the prophets are the way it's sometimes broken down. They have everything that we see in the Old Testament.
They pretend they are so knowledgeable, mm-hmm. the priests, then they should be aware of this as well.
Yes, they should. Even if they can't see the Old Testament prophecies that point to Jesus, they should still be able to see the moral teachings that suggest that the way that they're leading the people is wrong. I agree with you. But we don't give credence to the things that mess up our agenda. It's really interesting when he says that soon you will seek me and you will not find me. I don't know that he's referring to this, but it's really interesting to note that when Jerusalem fell in 70, that leading up to that time, when the Romans started to act, when they moved on the Holy Land, how dire things got. There was starvation. Crops were burned. Travel routes were blocked, and therefore food shipments were blocked. Ports were closed. And there was severe starvation. There was sickness. There was everything that happens when you don't have the nutrition and you don't have the access. The historian Josephus tells some horrifying episodes from this time in 70 and leading up to it. When Jerusalem fell, when the temple was torn down. I think it was, 2 years later when the siege at Masada was finally broken. Food became so scarce that if the zealot party, who saw themselves as the leaders of the rebellion, and therefore they had to survive, if the zealot party found out that somebody had gotten their hands on food, Josephus reports incidents where they would break into the homes, kill the family, rip out their gullets to get to the not yet digested food. Yeah, pretty horrific stuff. And of course, the people and the religious leaders are calling out to God. And some of them are preaching that, God is going to intervene here. And the zealots want God to intervene here. They're trying to create, I don't think they necessarily wanted to go quite the way it went, but they wanted to create the crucible that would lead to Yahweh's intervention. And Yahweh doesn't intervene. Yahweh is silent. And I read Jesus' words here that say, soon you will seek me and you will not find me. And I just wonder if he was looking forward to that time. Certainly there are other times where he's looking forward to the fall of Jerusalem. And he has prophecies about it. Maybe this is one. Because Yahweh did not save Jerusalem. He did not save Masada. He did not save the zealots. He did not save the temple. They were looking for him and they could not find him. Just 35 to 40 years after what we're reading here in John. Sobering stuff. Well, I don't want to get into the next section because I can't do it justice in the short time that I have. We finally get to Jesus talking about himself as the water of life in these next verses. But we'll have to satisfy ourselves for today with all of this table setting that John has done here at the Feast of Tabernacles. Rather than get directly into Jesus talking about himself in terms that fit the backdrop of Tabernacles, which we'll get to see in more detail next time, John has decided to set this out as a continuation of what had happened in John chapter 5 with the healing of the lame man and the confrontation with the leaders, and John chapter 6, where Jesus finally does begin to do things publicly and it drives people away. And those are the pieces that he brings together here in the opening of John chapter 7 to ratchet up the tension with the Jewish leadership, to show the divided reactions of the people. And that's what he lays out first. And then he will go into the water of life and the light of the world passages. So that'll have to wait. Any other thoughts or comments or questions? Elmer?
Christ, different times, has made comments about the Sabbath. He didn't want to miss a passage here. And somebody's quote is saying, man is not made for the Sabbath. Or
But the Sabbath is made for man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess the thought that popped in my head, kind of a question, in these 900 soul bylaws they've got, the sidebars on the interpretation of the commandments, how much of that was regarding the Sabbath day? Like you could only walk so far on the Sabbath, you couldn't cook meals on the Sabbath, all that. Were they becoming work-oriented that if they kept the Sabbath, they were a good, upstanding Jew then? Kind of three or four questions.
And they're good questions. I can't give them a definitive answer out of my own knowledge. How important was the Sabbath in the rabbinic code, the rabbinic traditions? You mentioned 900 some sort of sidebar tenets to be observed, but even just the Torah has nearly 700. So there's plenty of them out there, but how many of them have to do with the Sabbath? I'll say this. We know that the Sabbath was sort of the default feast. We know that the Sabbath was sort of the mark of Judaism. Think about those diaspora Jews that they thought Jesus was going to go minister and preach among. The Jews who are in Asia Minor, the Jews who are in Rome, the Jews who are in maybe North Africa, wherever it may be. They're existing in a society that doesn't have a Sabbath. And the one thing, if people don't know anything else about the Jews in their own city, out there in the diaspora, the one thing they know is that the Jewish shops are closed one day a week. The rest of us are doing our business, and for some reason that group shuts down. Why are they shutting themselves off from 13%, 14% of their possible profits? I don't understand it. But those Jews always shut their doors. They always roll up their awnings and stay closed for that one day a week. Sabbath was a visible sign of being Jewish. And so it's an important symbol, regardless of how many of the rabbinic tenets actually address it directly.
And then Christ, he preached on Sunday. And the church took up the tradition of having Sunday services instead of the Sabbath necessarily.
That's true. Jesus was raised on a Sunday. The church took up Sunday as the day to commemorate that resurrection. Although there's some interesting things to dig and try to get timelines on about that, but that's not what we're here for today. See, when Jesus said the Sabbath was not made for, that man was not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath was made for man, that's a really good sort of summary statement, really good sort of summary statement about the law in general. And to key it off of the Sabbath is a good place to key it off, because the Sabbath is prominent, especially symbolically. Because what he's really saying is, man wasn't made to observe the Torah. The Torah was made to help man live with God, understand God, see his need for God's mercy. He wasn't made to obey Torah. That wasn't the point. Man wasn't made for Torah. the Torah was made for the sake of mankind. Sabbath is just a piece of it that's used to represent the whole. There's a literary term for that. Anybody recall what it is? I don't right now. Synecdoche, maybe? Anyway, doesn't matter. Yeah, absolutely so. Any other thoughts or questions? Okay, then let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much as we see how hard it was for people to see what Jesus was trying to tell them. Thank you so much that it does not depend on our ability to understand, but it depends entirely upon your grace and your mercy and your spirit, and that you draw to yourself those whom you want to save. Because if it were up to us, we would be just as lost as many of the people we see in these stories. Thank you for that grace and that mercy. Thank you for that desire to see the salvation of your people. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.